Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ sanghaṃ namassāmi. Third talk of our 2004 Rains Retreat. Still, I'm going to be focusing on the way of meditation. This is the heart of our practice. Even Sila Samadhi Panya, the triple practice which defines what we do as monks, novices, anagarikas, lay visitors to this monastery. In the center of that is Samadhi, this ability to sustain the attention on one thing to the point that things start to disappear and the mind focuses and becomes still, mindfulness in power, blissful, goes deep inside, eventually through the nimittas into the jhanas. It's a beautiful path. And I stress this path again and again and again, simply because that is the path which leads to nibbana, which leads to insights. I cannot see that any possibility of gaining those insights without the experience of the jhanas. This is how I see things. So I'm encouraging again and again to gain those experiences, but one doesn't gain those experiences through wanting them, as many of you will know. They're born of letting go, the stages of letting go, the stages of renunciation. The joy of the jhanas is viveka sukha, the bliss of having given up, of renouncing. And each one of these experiences are built up on that ability to go against the stream of doing and controlling and just allowing the mind to settle into the moment, into the silence, into the breath, into the beautiful breath, into the nimitta, into the jhanas and beyond. It's a way of practice. However, that until one knows that route very well, there's always problems and difficulties. In particular, I've been telling a few people at the interview times that sometimes we do need to put forth some will, some controlling effort. And I've shied away from talking about that for a while, even though the last talk I sort of alluded to putting passion into the meditation, into the moment, giving this moment everything you've got. But sometimes a little bit of control does help. But the general rule of thumb is that we control too much. That's why I always start the retreat on telling people to let go, relax, rest, don't do so much, because we are compulsive doers. As Ajahn Chah famously said, if you're leaning to the left, he tells you to go to the right. If you're leaning to the right, he tells you to go to the left. And there in the middle, you see, the balance. The balance with doing, always remember this, the beginning of your meditation, then it needs a very gentle bit of controlling, just to tell the mind to watch the breath, or to do the present moment awareness and silence first of all, whatever you start off with. So guide the mind onto the breath, but not too firmly, to gentle persuasion, almost like encouragement. The beginnings of the meditation can withstand a little bit of effort and controlling. In the middle stages of the meditation, such as the beautiful breath, you shouldn't do very much at all. Just at the very most, a gentle nudge. In the deeper stages of meditation, the nimitta and obviously beyond, you shouldn't do anything at all. As you go deeper and deeper, you need more skill in letting go and abandoning. And it's as if, at each stage of the meditation, like I wrote in one of those journals, each stage in the meditation is a little test for you, and if you pass that test of letting go, then you get the more difficult and refined test. You start off with letting go of coarse things. Just to come to this monastery, you've let go of so many coarse things. You've already achieved so much by letting go of the world. Now when you sit on your pillow, or sit on your cushion or your stool or whatever, you have to be asked to let go of something more. You have to let go of time. If you pass that test in the present moment, then you're given the harder test of letting go of this chattering mind. So only if you pass that test can you actually go on to the breath and actually watch that breath. Strange that sometimes that we just pass the initial tests. We're not sort of really passing, we bypass them. We don't really do them. We don't train ourselves on the course subjects. We just run off to the refined subjects. And when we run off too fast, too much ahead of ourselves, it's no wonder we fail and get frustrated in our meditation path. We haven't really focused on the foundations. Even in school, you have to pass grade 1 before you can go to grade 2, and then grade 3 and grade 4. And people who just bypass those early years find that there's something they've lost, a foundation which they haven't really built up. In the later years, they fail. Stage by stage. And as one lets go of one stage, there's a more refined thing to let go of. So remember, letting go is not controlling. So control is let go of stage by stage by stage. The simile which I've used, which sometimes makes sense to people, is a simile of the ladder. When you're going up a ladder, you have to grasp onto the rung above you. Hold on to it tightly. Because only by holding on to the ladder above you can you pull yourself up to go higher up that ladder. It happens that now you're standing on that rung you once were grasping above you. Now it's below you. Now's the time to let it go. So you let go of things stage by stage by stage. This is why that the things one grasps onto in the beginning, like that famous happiness which I say, the beauty, the joy of meditation, grasp onto that at the beginning. Later on, especially in the nimitta stage, then's the time to let go of that. Actually, you let go of it, you just get a different type of happiness, more refined, more beautiful. But everything you have to do, you grasp above you, and you let go of what's below you, as it were. So you can put some effort in the beginning of the meditation, the aspiration to actually just sit down there and spend time there. But it has to be a gentle, too much of an aspiration, too much of desire. You find will just frustrate the mind. You get stiff. There's no softness in that mind. You have to be a friend to your mind. Look upon your mind as something not belonging to you, as if it was a being independent of you. If you look at your mind as independent of you, it doesn't follow your orders and controls, but you can influence it, just like you can influence a good friend. And if you look at your mind in that way, you will know how to work with this good friend or your mind. If you force it too much, it will turn against you and be your enemy. It will throw tantrums in your meditation. It will not allow you to find stillness. It will always be running backwards and forwards because you've mistreated it. So treat your mind kindly like you would treat any other friend. And if you treat your mind kindly and you care for it, then your mind will care for you and it will treat you well. And you can actually nudge, encourage, inspire your mind to walk with you on this path of meditation. So it's not an enemy anymore. It's not something you're trying to control and force into being still. It's something which cooperates in this path of letting go. So be careful of that forcing, but encouraging actually works. So you can encourage your mind at the beginning of the meditation to inspire it. Give it a direction where you want to go in this path of meditation. But remember that simile of the taxi driver which I invented a few years ago. If you want to go to the airport, you tell the taxi driver, I want to go to Perth International Airport. Every taxi driver in the city knows where that is. You don't have to tell them twice. Once is enough. With your mind, maybe three times at the beginning, because that's our tradition. Mind, this is where I want to go. Mind, this is where I want to go. Mind, this is where I want to go. That's what I mean by the extent of controlling. Giving yourself clear instructions, psyching yourself up, pointing the mind in the correct direction. And then letting it go into that direction of letting go, renouncing, giving up. A little bit of direction helps. We also have to know what that direction truly is. it's much more effective to not say, get into the beautiful breath, or get into the nimitta, or get into jhanas. It's much better to actually to tell the mind to create the causes. This is a big point in one's meditation. The order is to create the causes for deep meditation, not the effect. Because this is where the work lies, in the causes. You tell the mind to be at peace, to grow in peace. Tell the mind to abandon, to let go of things. Tell the mind to be content. This is good enough. This beautiful mantra, which many of you are already practicing, and many more of you can take up in on your walking path, or when you're eating, or when you're doing your chores, or whatever else you're doing in this monastery. This is good enough. This is good enough. This is good enough. I know from experience you can gain those jhanas from almost any state of mind when you begin. It's a fascinating thing, the sort of experiments which you've done in your monastic life. Just for the sake of testing out the Dhamma, sometimes I've the most unlikely sort of states of mind, just the tired states of mind, the sick states of mind, the busy states of mind, and you've just been rushing about doing your duties and serving others, the sort of mind states which you shouldn't be able to get any depth of meditation. I've found from my own experience you can get into deep meditation from any beginning. It's fascinating. And that's why I invented that simile of opening up the lotus. The most dirty, disgusting, wrinkled, dusty lotus you can imagine. Inside of it is the most wonderful petals. So fragrant, so refined. Every moment, right inside of this, is the most beautiful freedom of the mind. So what's on the outside, what you usually recognize, is not important. You can use anything. So in understanding that, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, at any moment, one can actually practice, this is good enough. This is good enough for the path of peace. This monastery, your room, the food, your body, this situation, the heat, the cold, whatever. So stop trying to control the outside world. This is good enough. And each one of you have got the abilities, have got the path in front of you. There's no insurmountable obstacles to achievement. Understanding that, you create the causes. You tell the mind, it's for peace, for renunciation, for this is good enough, for letting go. For going inwards, not going onwards. That's why if ever the thought comes up in your mind, what should I do next? That should ring alarm bells. What should I do next is the wrong question. It's going off into the future. It's what you're doing now. That's the only focus for the mind. Next is just the future, it's a fantasy. The past is just already a moment ago, it's gone past its use-by date. Abandon. The thought of what should I do next just never comes up. So the mindfulness gets focused in the present moment. So this is good enough. Renunciation, freeing the mind. That word analio in the Third Noble Truth. Having no roosting, you're not sticking on anything or any place. As soon as this moment disappears, you allow it to completely disappear. You don't hold on or stick or roost or stand on anything whatsoever. The mind is always just going inwards, deeper in every moment. So give yourself that instruction on what the path is, where you're going. You're going inwards, not onwards. You're focusing, not diversifying. Going into the silence, not thinking about it. You're experiencing it without giving it a name. Give yourself clear instructions. However, there's many instructions you could give. So keep it simple. Say one or two things and leave it at that. One of the important things to say at the beginning of your meditation, as well as giving yourself directions, is what I've told many of you in interview time, to program your mind to avoid the hindrances or the obstacles which you sometimes face. For many of you, there'll be a recurring hindrance, something which keeps coming up time and again in your meditation, which blocks your progress. I gave that simile of a snake within those monasteries in Thailand. This is true that sometimes you didn't have any flashlight and no sandals. You'd go barefoot through the forest at night. There's so many things which would bite you, and sometimes dangerous things like snakes. If you stepped on them, they would bite. Usually they'd leave you alone. So the only way which I avoided getting bitten was to actually to psych myself up after the evening meeting. Imagine yourself after this talk walking back to your hut without a flashlight, without sandals, and if there's crawling with snakes like in Thailand. The only way you could survive is knowing that that was a danger, you're going to be on the lookout for it. This is how I used my mind for meditation. Whatever my obstacle was, whether it was a restless mind or thinking or naming things, I identified that snake which I'd seen just in the last week many, many times hindering my meditation. I identified it and told myself to look out for that. I told myself at the beginning of the meditation, say it was like restlessness or excitement, say excitement when the nimitta comes up. I'd tell myself at the beginning of the meditation, if you get to that nimitta stage, beware of excitement. If you get to that nimitta stage, beware of excitement. If you get to that nimitta stage, beware of excitement. I told myself that very clearly at the beginning of the meditation and forgot all about it. I knew that I was programming my mind, and of course when you got to that stage, excitement would start to bubble up, but the program would then cut in and you'd stop. It's marvelous actually to watch all of this happening, because at those deep stages of meditation you can't do anything. If you do, the whole thing just becomes unstable and all that hard work of letting go is all lost. So it's important to not do anything, but still you can give that little bit of control by programming the mind. And that programming the mind is just a powerful way of dealing with problems. Even if you get angry at people, or you talk too much, or you eat too much, or whatever else it is, program your mind, say, the next time I see that person, I'll be quiet. Next time I see that person, I'll be quiet. The next time I see that person, I'll be quiet. Forget about it, and you find that you program, conditioned your mind. The next time that person comes into your consciousness is before you. You're about to speak, but the conditioning comes in and stops you. That's how we control the mind. Gently, in a refined way. We don't go around sort of, come on mind, do this, come on, do that, come on, you have to do this, don't do that, because then you just get so stiff and so bored and your noisy, controlling, restless mind. Meditation is far more refined. And that way that you can let go of the biggest hindrance, which is your thinking and controlling mind. You've got a little bit of control at the beginning, but so refined, so gentle. You're not like a US Marine. You're like this musician with this very, very gentle touch on the piano or whatever else you're playing. You're refined. And with that refined skill, you find you can ease your mind into these deep meditations. You can be a friend of that mind. And you find that that gentleness, that sensitivity, that softness is all that's required. And you do get peaceful meditations, and you enjoy it, and you find out these instructions actually work, and you get closer to these beautiful jhanas and these nimittas. But whenever you do get a nice meditation, again what I've been telling people in their interviews, when a good meditation comes up, contemplate that at the very end. Find out what it was like and what you did to actually to achieve such a state. Thereby, you're doing this method of learning by your successes. Just recently in Armadale group, someone said, oh, shouldn't you learn from your mistakes? I said, no. forget your mistakes, forgive them. Let them, don't even think about them, they'll just depress you and take away your energies. Learn from your successes. Learn from what went right. It's a much more powerful way of learning. Even in education, that's called like positive reinforcement. Educational psychology, which I learned 32 years ago when I was a school teacher, told that's the best way of training children. It's the best way of training yourself in meditation as well. Any silly bad meditations, just leave them alone. Just don't even think about them. Just walk away from them. And don't even carry them into the future. Completely forget. Had a good meditation, remember that one. Analyze it. What did you do? And why did you get peaceful? Because we're learning from our successes that way. And you find you've let go of something. You followed the instructions. It worked. You was right. Now when you learn from those instructions, then put those same causes into place again. We recreate the causes. Recreate the causes. Recreate the causes. And then we get the same effect. Because this path of the Buddha is all of a cause and effect path. That's why it's very sort of like science. Like engineering of the mind. You put this in place and this is what happens. If you put the same things in place again, the same thing happens again. So you get this ability to meditate. You know exactly what you need to do. What button needs to be pushed. Where that button is. You put the causes into place and everything falls into line. One of the causes obviously is patience. Because patience is actually waiting in the moment. Not expecting something. Because if you're expecting something, again you're off in the future again. You wait in this moment. Because everything you ever want is right in this moment. It's not in the next moment. So all desires just disappear. All craving goes. In this moment, no matter what it is, it will grow and develop into the jhanas, into the truth. So that we create the cause of peace. We create the cause of not moving from the moment. We create the cause of just being silent and not judging and talking about this moment. We create the cause of just the stillness which allows joy and happiness to bubble forth, to arise. Like joy and happiness is just like this flower which is growing and growing and growing within you. It will come in its own time. Don't go looking for it. Just wait and allow it to come. Too often in my life I went seeking things. I remember one story in Wat Nanachat when we used to dye our own robes, especially for an ordination. And sometimes when we're dyeing our robes, we're at the dye pot for several nights in a row. This particular occasion, I was one of my friends was doing some dyeing. And they promised me they'd come at 3 o'clock to give me a cup of tea, because if you were up all night, you were allowed to have tea and coffee at the dyeing shed. And I thought 3 o'clock, I awoke a bit early, about 10 to, so I thought I'd go up to there and get my cup of tea. And I walked to the dyeing shed, expecting a cup of tea when I got there. I heard the bell on the way when I got there. The dyeing shed was abandoned. They finished the dyeing. Those lazy monks had gone to sleep, I thought. So I missed my cup of tea. And then I found out later on after alms round, the monk was supposed to bring me my cup of tea. He said, "Where were you at 3 o'clock? Because at that particular time when the bell came, they'd have gone on another route. They'd brought a cup of tea to my hut, but had I waited, I'd have got it. Instead, I went looking for it and I missed it." I use that as a great teaching for my life. If you go seeking for the cup of tea, you always miss it. If you wait, it comes to you. I learned that in meditation. You don't go seeking. These are the joys and the bliss. You don't look for the nimitta. You wait. And the nimitta comes to you. It's cause and effect, that's all. You don't go looking for the jhanas. If you go searching for them, they come by another path. And when they visit, you're not at home. And they go somewhere else. Always remember to stay in the moment. Be still. These are the teachings about meditation. You should know that by now. Remember, the obstacles to meditation are the hindrances. What are those hindrances? There's desire, which is sensory desire, wanting something. But in particular, there's that very refined hindrance of the desire, which is concerned with your body. And the five senses are those things which are supposed to control and guard this body. Five senses are so caught up and engaged with this body, that when this body dies, the five senses die with it. So this sensory pleasure, sensory comfort is all concerned with this body. That is the first hindrance, the inability to just abandon and let go of this body with its five senses. It's not just pleasure. That's why we can't stop listening to things, even during meditation. We can't stop feeling the body. Even in Singapore, during one of the retreat I taught recently, one of the people was saying they were getting peaceful, but then they started to feel these aches, these itches in their body. And I told them what had happened, because I know exactly what happens at that stage. You're getting very, very peaceful, but subconsciously, or when you're not mindful enough to watch it happen, then what happens is that you get scared. You can't feel the body anymore. The senses start to disappear. And so you deliberately excite those senses to get them going again. You're not at ease when they disappear. It's you who went looking for those pains and itches in the body. It's you who went looking for the sounds in your ear. You actually went out there to do something to spoil the peace you were afraid of. You know that. And program your mind never to do that again. If I'm peaceful, I'll enjoy that peace. I won't go looking for something to disturb myself. I'll be at ease with that peace. I'll be at ease with that peace. I'll be at ease with that peace. Even the thinking mind. Why do the thinking mind suddenly interfere? Again, because you disturb yourself. You're afraid of the silence. The more you meditate, the more successful you are in your meditation, the more peaceful, silent, blissed you are, the more familiar you are with that territory. When you're familiar with that territory, you feel so much at ease in the bliss, in the silence. You don't need to disturb yourself anymore. That familiarity is a way of overcoming that sensory desire. The familiarity with letting sensory desire go and realizing it is more beautiful, more peaceful, more free, more pleasurable. If you have something better, it's more easy to give up something inferior. So when you do get deep meditations, you reflect about it, you know what it feels like, and why it's pleasurable, because you've given up so much. Why didn't I give up that again? And you do. You give up disturbing yourself, that first hindrance of sensory desire, of ill will. Many meditators run on ill will. They don't like themselves, they don't like this moment, they get a present moment, that's not good enough, silence, yuck. They get the breath up and they can't stand it. Not at the beginning anyway. Have you ever noticed ill will towards the breath? That what makes you tense up. I don't want it to be this way, I want it to be something different. That's why meditation with loving kindness is just so powerful. You have loving kindness onto the breath. This friend of yours, that's why I say I anthropomorphize my meditation objects, whether it's my mind, present moment, silence, or the breath. I look upon that as another being who's going to be my friend. Ill will towards a friend is no way to keep their company. So look at that ill will which many of you have. You may not notice it and see it. If you cannot stay with that object, you cannot stay with the breath, say, very often it's because of ill will. You don't want to be like this. It's called ill will. With loving kindness, you can just be at peace with that breath. As it is, the door of my heart's open to you no matter what you are. The door of my heart's open to this moment. The door of my heart's open to the silence. The door of my heart's open to the breath. My heart's open to the beautiful breath, even though it can be scary at times. That loving kindness softens your mind. It opens the mind to this moment, and it keeps the attention there. That's why to be able to do loving kindness together with this meditation object, this is so, so powerful. As I remember that monk, he did a retreat and did loving kindness on the breath and got into a jhana, dreamt of jhana, and as soon as woke up in the morning, was this powerful nimittas. So what happens when you do this? You're getting rid of the obstacles. Restlessness always comes from discontent. That's the third hindrance. So make more contentment. This is good enough. Otherwise, you'll always be running somewhere else in your life. This is all you've got. Make the most of it. And you can make everything out of this moment. You don't have to run to another hut. Don't have to run to another cushion. Don't have to run to another moment. That restlessness all keeps you coming here and going there. I think many of you know my resolution I made years ago. It's a great resolution for my monastic life, but it also helped me with my meditation. I made a resolution I would never ask to go to any monastery. If I was sent, I would go, but I would never request to leave. That's why I never went to any places when I was a monk. Even when it was my Tudong year, I was supposed to go wandering. I remember very clearly just in this monastery, Wat Nanachat, all the other monks were going, and Ajahn Jakwa was the abbot there. And he said, Ajahn Brahm, you've been here a long time. When are you going to go on Tudong? I said, oh, thank goodness you asked me. Because of my resolution. If you hadn't have asked me, I couldn't have gone. And so I went the next day. When I came here, 21 years ago. No one's asked me to go yet, so I'm still here. Imagine watching your breath. No one asks you to go, so you stay there. You stay on your breath. You don't go anywhere. You don't go seeking a better place to hang out. This is good enough. Imagine hanging out with your breath for 21 years. What's going to happen? You're just going to go deep into that breath. You're going to know it like your closest of friends. Probably spend more time with my breath than with any of you. If anyone asks me what's my closest friend, it would probably be the breath. If anyone says, what's your next of kin? Say the nimitta. So if I get sick, that's who you should call and let know what's happening. They can decide my funeral. So you understand just what you hang out with. If you hang out with these things a lot, that's, you know, your friend. You can understand that restlessness doesn't actually come into the picture. This is your refuge, your resource, where you go to, where you hang out. So where do you hang out in your mind? Who is your best friend of your mind, your mental best friend? So if you can start to do this, restlessness disappears. And the same with sort of sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor, you've heard me talk about that before. That is not the big problem in your meditation. People think it is, because when you start, you get sleepy and you're not getting interested at all. And if you're sleepy, sleep. Don't fight, make peace. Don't have ill will towards sloth and torpor, otherwise you get two hindrances going at the same time. You get all confused. Have loving kindness to your sloth and torpor. In a while, it will disappear. I promise you. But if you struggle with sloth and torpor, when it disappears, next you're in restlessness. And after restlessness for a while, you'll just wear yourself out, you get into sloth and torpor again. The karmic result of restlessness is sloth and torpor. The karmic result of fighting sloth and torpor is restlessness. So don't make bad karma. Loving kindness, you can't go wrong. Peace, renunciation, letting it go, letting it be. You can't go wrong with those attitudes, because they fight the defilements. Sloth and torpor, I know you. You just past karma, old karma, from what I've done in the past. Allow it to happen. Bear with it. Be patient. Just wait. Just know what's happening as best you can. Leave it alone. Don't do anything. Don't struggle. Don't strive. Don't control. And after a while, sloth and torpor just vanish away. You're mindful. And you get power mindfulness. You get joy. You get happiness. You don't get sloth and torpor when you get that happiness. You can't be happy and dull at the same time. So when the happiness starts to bubble up, because it's happiness coming from energy going into the knower, no doing anymore, that hindrance is gone. You can meditate late into the night. Sometimes you don't feel like sleeping. You just lay down. You just close your eyes and you sleep just so lightly. You wake up in the morning full of energy again. You don't even need to jump up and say zippity-doo-dah. Just, you already got zippity-doo-dah in your nimittas just coming up. And this is how we overcome those hindrances. And of course, the doubt, we overcome doubt through our experience, especially by briefing, or rather debriefing after the meditation is over. Why? What happened? Why was it beautiful? Why did it work? And little by little, when one practices this way, one finds one's overcoming those hindrances. One knows them very well, one knows how to overcome them. And you always notice those hindrances are just that relationship you have between the knower and what you're experiencing. So you look at that area. It's not what you're experiencing is the hindrance, it's how you're experiencing it. I press this point because it's a powerful place where we can overcome hindrances very easily. And that's part of our job, meditating, overcome those hindrances. It's not what we're looking at, but why, or how we're looking at it, our relationship to this object in front of us. If it's got ill will or desire, sensual desire, restlessness, sloth and torpor, or doubt, if we're looking at it with doubt, then of course that's a hindrance. It's not going to work. We overcome those hindrances in a gradual training. This has to come first, overcoming the hindrances before we gain those jhanas. So this is actually our path to overcome those hindrances, and then the path into deep meditation is open to you. And that's how it's done. And it's not that hard. You just keep on going. Follow the instructions. Be mindful. The beautiful part of this meditation retreat is that you've got 3 months to do this. And naturally, the energies build up. The less you do, the less you struggle, the less you try and control, the more energy goes into the knowing. You find it in these long retreats, as long as you follow the instructions, you keep your seclusion, you don't go wasting your time, you stay alone as much as possible, you put your bum on the cushion, put your feet on the path as much as you possibly can, you'll find that just the energies start to rise, the peaceful energies. You get into the meditation, you become the real hermit. You become the meditator. You become naturally peaceful in your meditation. You find you can do it. And when you do get success in the meditation, it's nothing to do with you. Don't get proud. It's just what happens on the path. That's why in one of those suttas, it used to be one of my favorite suttas years ago, the Sapurisa Sutta, I think, or Sapurisa Pugala Sutta, where it said about this monk who was just gaining all these jhanas. I think first of all he started keeping his precepts, but he never thought because he kept his precepts that he's better than anybody else. It wasn't a cause for his conceit. And after keeping his precepts, he abandoned the 5 hindrances and got the first jhana. So just because I got first jhana, he doesn't make a self out of that and think he's better than anybody else. And then second jhana, doesn't think he's better than anybody else. A beautiful way of talking about it, but how can you do that? If you've got a jhana, how can you think you're not better than anybody else? Because it's not you who's done that. It's not a personal achievement. It's a personal letting go. It's just what happens when you let go of things. It's just part of the path. So the more one abandons the sense of self, the doer, me in control, the person you call yourself, the more you abandon that, the easier it is. The less you have to give up, the easier it is to let go. So don't actually make such a huge big thing about you and your achievements or your lack of achievements, what you can do, what you can't do. That's all rubbish. the eye doesn't come into it. We abandon that sense of self. That's why a little bit of anatta sanya, non-self, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not a self. The food you eat, that's not me, that's not mine, that's not a self. Even the actions you've done in the past, that's not me, that's not mine, that's not a self. Abandon them, walk away from them. You don't need to feel guilty, you don't need to feel upset, you don't need to feel anything. Throw all the past away. Never, never carry the past into the present moment. And you can do that with a bit of anatta sanya, the developing the perception of not self, not me, not mine, not a self. This pain is not me, not mine, not a self. This smell is not me, not mine, not a self. This sound you're hearing now is not me, not mine, not a self. Don't try and remember these things. Don't try and catch on to them. Fortunately, you don't have to these days. You can even fall asleep during the talks because they're all recorded. So if you fall asleep during this talk, sadhu, 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 you're not grabbing onto anything. The point is, sort of allow that nature to happen. It's not you. It's just the nature of the five khandhas. Five khandhas doing their thing. If you really let go and put this letting go into these five khandhas, just the five khandhas as they just unwind. It's beautiful to watch these five khandhas just unwind. Things just fall apart. Things go still. This whole movement, this trembling of the khandhas starts to settle down. It's just like a jelly stops wobbling and becomes this beautiful radiant jewel. This beautiful radiant jewel of your mind. That's wobbling at first and that starts to settle down. All the vibrations disappear and gets very cool. The vibrations is what temperature is. So as one cools down, all the heat disappears. And you go to absolute zero of nibbana, but there's no movement at all. Complete cessation of all movements of the mind. That's what it is. All consciousness, all perception is just movement of the mind. See if you can stop moving and be absolutely still. In that stillness is beauty, is peace, is emptiness, is happiness. That's what one's doing in one's meditation. You can use insight, but it's the insight into the way of meditation. The first half of a retreat, don't try and figure out the Dhamma and become enlightened. Get the jhanas first and then enlightenment comes next. Don't get it the wrong way around. So all the insights, all the investigations should be how I can get deeper in meditation. What is my obstacle? Why am I stuck at this stage? What is the hindrance? What am I attaching to? You must be attaching to something, grasping on something. There's an I in there somewhere doing that attaching, doing that grasping. Otherwise, you just go deeper. Again, that's a fascinating path which I've used in the meditation. You get so far and then you come across this brick wall. Instead of just pushing, I stop and say, why? And I know what to look for. It's me in there doing something. I've attached to something, I've got in control again. I put my hand on the steering wheel and mess things up. And you look around that, and I use this investigation. And you look around until you recognize what the problem is. This is so wonderful when you recognize the true problem. Just in that recognition itself is the letting go. It follows automatically. You recognize what you're holding on to, and then you let it go. Ajahn Chah used to say it's like a person holding a hot coal. As soon as you recognize what you're doing, you let it go straight away. That's what happens. As soon as that recognition happens, so that investigation done are the obstacles to deep meditation. The recognition comes up, the obstacles let go of, and you always go this into a deeper state of peace. You really get a lot of joy out of that. You've been stopped, now you've got the deeper state. It's just so blissful and joyful when that happens. And then you go a little bit deeper until you come across another obstacle, you can't go further, and you investigate again. What am I holding on to? Where's this I in here somewhere? Still a lingering self, sense of self or ownership or control here. What am I letting go of? Is it my ear and the sound? I'm not letting go of. I really think that this is important. When you abandon all sound, you don't hear anything then. You abandon this control of this doer. You see that very clearly. I know this doer so well. You stop it. Throw it away. And you get so peaceful. This is so easy. So this is actually how we meditate. Tricks of the trade. Tips. The last trick which I wanted to remind you of. You're meditating a lot now, spending a lot of time on the path or on the cushion. Be careful not to spend too much time. Even the Buddha said, if you give exclusive attention to samadhi, you can get dull. So find things which inspire you. As the Buddha said to his cousin Mahanama, because Mahanama had faith, he said, reflect upon the Buddha or the Dhamma or the Sangha. Until you get inspired, you get this inspiration, you get Dhamma Veda and Atta Veda, the inspiration in the Dhamma, or inspiration into the consequences of that Dhamma. Until you get fired up. If you can't get inspiration that way, those of you who've been on pilgrimage, remember those places where you sat meditation. Until the electricity starts coming up the back. You feel just this amazing power that you sat where the Buddha sat. You've meditated where Sariputta was enlightened. If that doesn't get you inspired and energized, I don't know what will. Well, this evening you can think of those of you who've met Ajahn Panyawada, Ajahn Mahabua's senior Western disciple. He's no longer. He's died. As you will. That should get you going. His was a life well spent. So many years as a monk, one of the great teachers of Thailand. That should inspire you. If that's not the case, then if it's some your favourite sutta, or the favourite sort of sayings, your favourite little book, keep that during this range retreat, the favourite discourse on the tapes, or chanting or whatever, and use that to inspire yourself. To empower the meditation. Because otherwise, if you're just sitting, walking, sitting, walking, sitting, walking, many of you will get dull. Just the mind won't cooperate anymore. You've got to give it a little bit of sweet if you're going to take the medicine. And inspiration is a power source for the mind. So don't forget to inspire yourself. Favorite talks, favorite chanting, or whatever. But don't inspire yourself in reading novels. That's not inspiration. That's expiration. The opposite of inspiration is expiration. You're expiring from the path. You're going to die. You can die as a monk, die as a novice, die as an anagarika. That's what I mean by expiring. So it's insight, not excite. Go in. Inspire. And that way you'll energize yourself. And you'll get these beautiful states of meditation, which you aspire towards. Which I keep talking about. I keep talking about these things again and again because I know that by such talking I'm programming your minds, setting the stage so that you too experiences those bliss in the minds called the jhanas. These are Uttari Manusa Dhamma, Mahagata Dhamma, states of superior humans, Mahagata, they've sort of gone to greatness, they are part of the path, an important stage which each one of you can achieve. Just get these states in this wasa, this range retreat, by following the instructions carefully. And you're standing in the footsteps of the Buddha, as it says in the Chulahatipadopama Sutta. If that doesn't inspire the pants off you, I don't know what will. You get in those stages and then you start crying when you remember them. And then, so with that type of joy and happiness, you don't want anything else. You give up wanting. You're so close to Nibbana, post-jhana. So that's where the enlightened experiences happen. So I'm not just talking about Dhamma before one has really strengthened one's meditation. Sat under the tree of stillness. Walked. So peaceful. You don't want anything in the world. Let go of your desires, freeing yourself from the burden of craving. You can do this. Go ahead. Stop messing around. but not just through will, through wisdom power. Remember the teachings, put them into practice, and you find there's so much information, there's so many techniques. Can't see why you don't achieve the dhyana in this range retreat. Go for it. That's the end of the talk.
Satipano Bhagavato Sāra.